Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Today on the show, all of your questions about voting in the upcoming election answered.
I don't think maybe some voters realize that it is different by state, and I feel like Wyoming has some really good laws in place.
Plus, a look at contested Wyoming House races in the general. And on the Wind River Reservation, one tribal member is leading a program to help people coming back from prison stay out.
She can relate to everything, as in all of it, you know, like the prison system, the probation system, being an addict, everything, you know.
A photographer talks about what motivates him to go to the front lines of some of the largest fires in the state.
This is really what being on a hotshot crew is about. It's about the camaraderie.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Hey there, this is Kelly Trujillo. Join me Saturday mornings for Buffalo Grass, 11 to 1, on listener-supported Wyoming Public Radio. You'll hear the best in bluegrass music, old and new, plus Americana, folk, Western, and even a little bit of Celtic. That's Buffalo Grass, Saturdays at 11 on Wyoming Public Radio.
This is Classical Wyoming, with great music 24 hours every day. If you would like to see the playlist, go to classicalwyoming.org.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now?
That's right.
Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. The reign of world-famous grizzly bear 399 has come to an end. She was hit by a car south of Jackson. She was the oldest known reproducing female in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. A roadside bear, photos of the popular mama and her cubs circulated the world. She became an icon for conservationists, changing the way people think of grizzly bears. We hear from some of the people grieving the loss of the bear, known to some as the Queen of the Tetons.
My name is Tom Mangelson. I'm a nature photographer, wildlife photographer, living in Moose, Wyoming, on the edge of Grand Teton National Park. I first met 399 in 2006 in the early fall. So that was the beginning of my love affair with her year after year for 18 years. I would see her and her offspring, and she lost one cub about 12 years ago. And, she went out to the highway, picked up the little carcass, and took it into the woods and laid it down by a big log, and then she ran up and down the highway all night, bawling and foaming at the mouth. And, you know, it's like she didn't quite calculate that she had lost your cub somehow. I don't have kids, but I have a couple of special dogs and I've had animals all my life. I've never lost an animal. It's affected me as much as 399 getting killed.
My name is Joanna Allam, and I've lived in the area for a little over 6 years, and I work at Teton Science Schools. We had a really special moment of getting to see 399. And when I say we, I refer to my two daughters. We were so incredibly privileged to get to see her and her four cubs stroll right across the road and across the creek. I have a very vivid picture of my three-year-old hanging out of the car window, calling out, "I see you, 399. I shared the news with them last evening. My eight-year-old just dropped to the floor, kind of crumpled and started crying. I think they felt very sad that it had been human caused. It was really hard for them to accept.
My name is Sam Nierman. I've predominantly been working in education and conservation for different organizations throughout the valley here. It's something that I've been pondering and thinking about for quite some time. How is the legacy of this just spectacular bear going to come to an end? I mean, I think we are fully the guilty party here. We more or less nurtured this animal to feel okay being a roadside bear. You know, I say this with tremendous grief. This is like the logical death, right? A roadside bear being hit by a car. 399 was like our sports team. She was this kind of galvanizing force that unified so many people. And people fought for her, they cheered for her, they cared about her. And it's devastating to lose such a force here. And hopefully we can just come together and continue to live and embody her legacy.
I'm Renee Seidler, the executive director of the Jackson Hole Wildlife Foundation. Grizzly 399 made it really clear that there are bears in town that are searching for garbage, barbecues, birdseed, livestock grain. She was a catalyst for change for us to kind of get our ducks in a row on regulations and code and to work towards being able to enforce those things so that we really are living not adjacent to the wildlife, not in conflict with the wildlife, but living with the wildlife, with the wild animals being safe and us being safe.
My name is Suzanne Turnbull. I live in Poplar, Montana. I am a caretaker of our Yellowstone buffalo here. You know, as a Native American person, we feel, we believe that we're all related. So, you know, I see her as a mother, like I'm a mother, you know. So they're not just an animal, you know, they're a spiritual being as well. It's just really sad that that's the way it ended. But, you know, humans and wildlife don't always find a perfect balance of existence. She represented everything that is wild and free to me.
This story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach. You're listening to a part of a composition from Ann Gutzo, a Wyoming composer, named The Bear and the Eclipse. The song is dedicated to Grizzly 399, her cubs, and all the bears of Grand Teton National Park. Items recently made their way back to the Northern Arapaho tribe. Toys, beaded moccasins, and traditional dresses received a motorcycle and police escort on their journey from Casper to St. Michael's Mission on the Wind River Reservation. They were held by the Episcopal Church for the past 80 years. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports on this long-awaited homecoming.
Car after car pulls into a dusty parking lot on a hot Monday afternoon. People of all ages make their way to a courtyard known as the Circle, with old log and stone buildings around its edge. The crowd settles into folding chairs as Northern Arapaho tribal member Jordan Dresser steps up to the mic.
People always ask, how do tribes get back their items? And that's a very complicated process.
Today, the tribe is reclaiming hundreds of sacred and cultural items from the Episcopal Church.
The individual who collected the items is named Edith May Adams. And over time, she just bought these items and she just left them to the church itself.
Adams was a deaconess at the mission in the 1930s and 40s, who ran a small market and traded goods for Native-made items. Her collection was later moved to Laramie, then Casper. Dresser and others have tried to get the items back for decades. In the last 10 years, a slice of the items were loaned to the tribe. But now, the whole collection is back for good.
The big question is, what happens to these items? What do we do with them all? I think it's the site for a museum.
Dresser would like to transform the centuries-old mission and its now unused boarding school buildings.
That's the dorm that I was put in when I was a little girl in first grade.
There, students like Northern Arapaho elder Leona Buckman were separated from their language and culture.
And they took us to that building. The first thing they did was cut our hair. We had long hair.
That erasure went far beyond the schools.
You know, we'd have our sun dances and our ceremonies, but we'd have to hide. Our people would have to hide to have a ceremony.
Northern Arapaho elder William C. Hare emphasized that was part of a much bigger plan.
The federal government would subsidize missionaries if they go on to reservations, establish missions to Christianize and de-Indianize the Indian.
But despite all that,
they were unsuccessful. To this day, not one Indian has ever turned white.
Marion Scott, who turned 80 the day before the homecoming ceremony, was also a student at St. Michael's. She went to Casper earlier in the year to see the items in the collection, which were in storage at the church's diocesan office.
Every time we opened a box and we seen those things that were in there, I could actually feel those people who they belonged to. And it was very, very emotional.
The Northern Arapaho elder says it still is.
They're here now. They're back home.
The items were legally signed back to the tribe at the end of the ceremony. Afterwards, Crystal C. Baring, who directs the tribe's historic preservation office, says she thought she would never see this day.
There's been attempts in the past, and they were always told no.
The church is now being run by a standing committee.
They said, we should just give them back. They're yours. And so that just made me so happy and excited, and I was just ready for those words.
Mary Erickson is with the St. John's Episcopal Church in Jackson. She's been part of the effort to return the items.
Joyful. And some sadness that it took us this long.
The night before the homecoming, church leaders apologized to the tribe.
I think it is the beginning, just the very beginning of some healing in the relationship between the Episcopal Church of Wyoming and the Arapaho people, and that's a good thing.
The church owns about 100 acres of land nearby. Erickson says that could be the next thing to return.
Might be harder, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe now we've broken through, we can get that done more quickly, but I think that's an important conversation to have.
Reverend Roxanne Friday is Eastern Shoshone and Seneca.
I wish that there were people here that have gone now that could have shared this day with us, and you know, but they knew that it was coming.
She's the Episcopal priest for the still operating church at St. Michael's Mission.
One of the things I want to get done before I go from this earth is that this circle is revitalized with youth and things that we can do to help in the healing of generational trauma and all the things that we've dealt with in our lives.
The next step is to refurbish one of the buildings in the mission and create a museum for the community. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman in eFitty. A new program is helping Native Americans return home to the Wind River Reservation after being in prison. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Hearing one story over and over again gets pretty old pretty fast. On Morning Edition, you'll hear all kinds of stories, from the big news to things that are just fun. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
From 5 until 9 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more 4 times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Part of why I love Wyoming Public Radio is because it is probably the last remaining really truly valid radio format here in the U.S. because it still provides really valid content that you can't get anywhere else.
I love Wyoming Public Radio. It's just important.
Help celebrate I Love Wyoming Public Radio Week by clicking the I Love Wyoming Public Radio icon at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can access listener testimonials and find out how to record your own. Just look for I Love Wyoming Public Radio at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. For people who've been to prison, the odds of returning there after being released are high across the board. That rate is estimated to be 33% higher for Native American people. On the Wind River Reservation, a new agency is trying to reduce the likelihood that tribal members will go back to prison. As Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports, it's led by a member of the Northern Arapaho tribe who was recently released from prison herself.
Terry Smith is driving her white pickup truck across the storm-darkened community of Arapaho.
I know the Little Shields live here. I know the Whites live over here, last name Whites, T-Bearings over there.
Smith leads the Northern Arapaho Reentry Agency as its only employee. It started up this year after the tribe got a federal grant. It's meant to help Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribal members coming from prison readjust to life on the reservation and stay out of jail. Smith barrels across flat pasture land and the occasional smattering of houses, all of it sitting at the feet of the Wind River Mountains. Her eyes are busy with memories.
The house burned down, so now there's like a camper there. And one of my aunts lives there because she has no place to go and there's no electricity, no water, no nothing.
Difficulty finding housing is one of many hurdles people coming back from prison face. Smith was raised here and knows personally what can lead someone to get caught up with addiction and the law. That's because she was sentenced to 6 months in federal prison for conspiracy to distribute oxycodone.
I was away from my kids, I was away from my partner.
At the time, she was chief judge of the Wind River Tribal Court. But she lost her law license while in prison.
There's gonna be a lot of people who still view that side of me, but I know I've done the work to get better. You know, I did my time, I went to treatment.
She came home in 2021 and started over.
I'm so grateful to be able to pick my son up from school, to wake up and braid their hair, and to cook dinner for them.
When the funding for the reentry agency came through, a tribal leader told Smith to apply.
I honestly think this job's perfect for me right now, like, because I am getting a second chance. I want everyone to get that.
Smith turns into the town of Riverton.
We're going to pick up Tremaine. He's staying at Eagles Hope, right? It's a transitional living center.
Tremaine Thunder is a member of the Northern Arapaho tribe and Smith's first client. Thunder is one of 15 who she helps on a weekly basis. Last year, he was arrested and charged with illegal possession of a firearm.
When it came time for me to get released, I had nowhere to go. And that's where Terry came in. She helped me from the very start, even when I was in prison.
Smith helped him find a place to live when he got out.
She can relate to everything, as in all of it, you know, like the prison system, the probation system, being an addict, everything, you know. Her story inspires me so much, you know. It makes me want to do better, you know, because it can be done.
Smith also helps Thunder find a way to get to and from medical appointments and meetings with his federal parole officer.
If there's a document that I don't understand, I call her, you know, and it's just like, man, I don't understand this. Could you help me with it?
All right. Sure, you ready to go?
Yeah.
I think these programs are really important and long overdue.
Cheyenne Senator Afi Ellis is a member of the Navajo Nation.
To the extent that we can rely more on tribal governments and tribal courts to provide that those services, the better off I think everyone is.
Reentry services like Smith's are new to the Wind River Reservation and to many other tribal nations. Ellis says she supports Smith and the agency, but worries about its dependence on federal money.
We've seen this time and again in Indian country. Great idea, great program, here's some funding. Tribes get something going, and then money runs out. They lose the grant, and then the program's gone.
The Wind River Reservation also has a reentry court, separate from Smith's agency. It's largely made up of federal officials in Wyoming. Parolees like Thunder have to meet with the court regularly to make sure they're following its rules. Before the reentry court started up a year ago, tribal members had to travel all the way to Cheyenne or Casper to meet with the nearest district judge. Sunny Goggles is one of the tribal representatives on the court. Until it got going, more than 75% of people who had committed federal crimes on the reservation somehow violated the terms of their release.
Which just blows my mind. I mean, but I see it. I see it with family members and relatives.
For her, the bottom line will always be that the feds control the tribe's judicial system.
I like the feds that I work with, but I really think on the federal system, you know, it's a job. It's a job. I don't think their heart is in it. I don't think their heart is for our community. And unfortunately, we don't have control over these systems.
Back in Arapaho, Smith heads to the reentry agency office in Great Plains Hall.
This grant is just me in this office, right? That's all was written into that grant.
Smith says she looked to reentry agencies in Oklahoma and Minnesota for guidance on how to run hers. In the meantime, she's petitioning to get her law license back so she can help clients like Thunder even more.
I got letters of recommendation from my attorney friends and from Lee, the councilman. So I hope it goes well.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements in Arapaho.
The election is less than 2 weeks away, and many Wyomingites are already early or absentee voting. Wyoming Public Media's Nikki Woulette spoke with Converse County Clerk Karen Rimmer about how things are going and all the how do I and what ifs voters might have as they prepare to cast their ballot.
So we're about 2 weeks out from Election Day, and I'm curious what's been working smoothly and what are your biggest challenges or concerns so far?
Overall, it has gone smoothly, and I have to attribute a lot of that to just having really great staff. And we also have a really great group of election judges. It was a little rough before the primary due to the issues with the public testing, but we did retest.
The national headlines that I've been reading, there's been a lot of misinformation and maybe just confusion about how elections are done. You know, it varies state by state. Are you hearing some of those concerns locally?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we always do. And I think a lot of it is confusion, partly because I don't think maybe some voters realize that it is different by state. And I feel like Wyoming has some really good laws in place.
I'm hoping to kind of better understand how the process works. So let's say I'm registering to vote. How do you ensure that your list of voters is up to date and that I'm not voting if I shouldn't be?
Mm-hmm. So when anyone registers to vote for the first time, or if they have moved to Converse County from another county or another state, they do have to register to vote, and there's certain ID requirements that have to be met in order to register. Wyoming does not have residency laws, but we do have the registration form, which is a state form, and basically that person is attesting and they're swearing that this is who they are. You know, there's questions on there. Are you a felon, or are you a felon who's had your voting rights restored? Are you a citizen? There's also things we look at on the ID itself to help determine that. But then with our WyoRidge system, which is administered by the Secretary of State's office, the WyoRidge system is tied into Social Security Administration, DCI, vital records, and with the Wyoming Driver's License office with YDOT. And so when someone, their information is entered, WyoRidge will, you know, alert whoever's using the system that this person may be a felon or this person may not be a U.S. citizen, for example. But here's something to consider, too, is that in Wyoming, you can register to vote with an out-of-state driver's license. And since there are no residency requirements, that address on the driver's license at this particular time isn't what we look at. We are using the address that the voter gives us on that registration form, and they're swearing to us that that is their address.
How do you make sure that person isn't voting in both states?
That's one of the questions on the registration form, too. I'm going to pull one up here real quick. They're swearing that they haven't voted in another state or county. Now, if they are moving to any county within Wyoming from one county to another, if they have an active ballot, we'll see that because the Wild Ridge system will tell us that, you know, we'd pull up that voter and it would say in red, active ballot. And so we would know that that person already had a ballot issued to them. But if it's from out of state, we might not necessarily know that immediately. So that is something that we have to contend with.
When is the last day that I can register to vote, and how and where would I do that?
So by Wyoming law, 14 days prior to any election, if you register to vote, you have to cast your ballot at the same time. So if you're in a county where they have early absentee voting, like here, where you can come in and actually cast your ballot in the clerk's office, you would have to vote that day. In Wyoming, you can register to vote on election day and vote at the polls. I know every state doesn't have that, but Wyoming does.
How do I know that my ballot and my choices will be secret?
So the absentee ballots, they have a life cycle. Only the voter can request them. We will only mail it to your voter registration address. And then once we get it back, absentee ballots have a barcode on them. And so we have a tool where we can scan those in, and they're binked into our Wild Ridge system, and your ballot is considered received. It's not processed until we physically open those and run them into a tabulation machine. And the public can attend, and there's rules for observing and that kind of thing, one of which is no one can be within 10 feet of those ballots when we open them. So we have an absentee team. All those people have to be certified, and they have to swear an oath that they're going to uphold the law. We sort the envelopes by precinct. Then when we open them, we keep the envelopes, but we just turn the ballots over. And bear in mind, we're processing hundreds, and some counties process thousands of absentee ballots. So we don't have time to look and see what people have voted. We don't care.
Are there any reasons that my ballot wouldn't be counted?
Yeah, there's a few. The biggest one is you don't get it to us in time.
So no extended deadlines.
No extended deadlines. It is 7 p.m. If you're in line at the polls, you do get to vote. So that's really the only thing. The other way would be if you voted absentee and you didn't sign the envelope, because that is a requirement. If we get one in and we see that it's not signed, we'll call them and say, hey, you have to come in and sign your absentee ballot envelope. But if we were unable to get a hold of someone, we would not be able to count that ballot.
What if I start marking for one candidate, change my mind, and mark another candidate for the same race?
If it's an overvote, the machine will tell you that you have overvoted this particular race. And then it will ask you, do you want to return the ballot or do you want to cast it? And so if you cast it, the rest of your ballot counts, but that particular race will not count.
What about the flip side? If I don't like any candidates for a district?
That is totally fine. You do not have to vote for all of any measure or candidate or the number that are available. And so undervotes do not negate any portion of a ballot. And so, in fact, some people submit, believe it or not, completely blank ballots just because they want voter history.
What if my child colors on my ballot after I have voted and I still want to send it in?
So if your child colors on a ballot, you have a couple of options. One, you can go ahead and send it in. We get it. When we go to open our absentee ballots, we'll see that, but we don't have any option but to run it. There's a possibility that the machine might not accept it. It might say something like unreadable marks, especially if your child colored on the timing marks around the ballot. That's just a safety measure to make sure people can't create fake ballots, if you will.
Wow, yeah.
We would probably have to spoil that ballot. You'd get voter history, but none of your votes would be counted, would be my guess. The better option for you would be to call us and say, hey, my child colored all over my ballots. Can I get a new one? And we would say, yes, you can. You would bring your ballot back in and we would literally spoil it, meaning we write spoiled across it. We keep that ballot because we track every ballot that we receive. And then we would issue you another one because you would only have one ballot at a time.
Converse County is using ballot drop boxes this year. How are you making sure that the ballots dropped into those boxes before Election Day are secure and that they're not tampered with or even replaced?
We check the ballot box twice a day. It's 24-hour surveillance, for one thing. The camera's on the inside of the building so that no one can tamper with that. And it's always lit up. And I have access to that footage. So that's step one. The ballot box is checked twice a day by two people. And then we have a log form. So we document what time the two people went out, who the two people were, how many ballots were received, and how many ballots were entered into the system. And then we basically just put those ballots. We have a locked box here in the courthouse, in the clerk's office, and they go into that box. And also in the clerk's office, this is important for us. This is not a requirement, but this is a policy decision that I made. We have two cameras in the clerk's office that are on 24/7 from the time the ballots are received by this office until the election is over.
How frequently are you reviewing the tapes from the cameras that are set up?
I check it every day. We also have cameras at the polling locations on Election Day for the same reason. It's not going to prevent something from happening, but if it does, we've given law enforcement a tool to maybe help them figure out what's going on and hold someone or some people accountable for whatever wrongdoing they did or tried to do.
Can I ask how long you've been the clerk in Converse County, and have you identified any fraud in your time there?
I was appointed in January of 2020. So we have had a couple instances of fraud that were not prosecuted. We've had two, I believe. They were both felons that had voted that was discovered after the fact.
So when an instance of fraud is identified after the fact, mm-hmm. Was that ballot included in the certified mm-hmm. count?
Yes, it was. Yep, there's no way to take that out. I mean, it is a big deal, but it's not a material error for the election. It did not affect the outcome of the election. We don't have a problem in Wyoming with voter fraud. We just don't. I think that's been proven over and over again. So.
Yeah, a couple isolated examples, but mm-hmm. there no widespread coordinated efforts.
No. There's no ballot harvesting in Wyoming. That doesn't happen here. I'm not quite sure how it could, the way that our absentee ballots are handled.
Would you be concerned, though, if someone showed up with 40 ballots to drop off at a single time?
I would absolutely be concerned with that, yes. Yep. Now, we have had people drop off two or three. It's typically here's mine and my wife's and my daughter's kind of a situation.
Like a household,
But if someone came in with 40, yeah, we would probably make sure that they stayed there and got some information from them until every ballot could be verified.
That was Converse County Clerk Karen Rimmer speaking about how to register and vote in the November 5th election. Next week, we'll hear about what happens after the polls close at 7 p.m. and clerks begin to tally results. Up next, we continue prepping for the election. We'll take a look at some contested races in the general. This is Open Spaces.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming sounds, jazz Wyoming, and classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
I'm Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, and a devoted listener to Wyoming Public Radio. When I'm in Wyoming and listening to Wyoming Public Radio, it's like another way to realize how incredible the relationship you can have between a radio and a listener is, because Wyoming is so sparsely populated. You are speaking to so many people who are spread out across this broad landscape, and you're having this interaction. I kind of think of it as similar to podcasting. You're putting your voice out there, and you're not really knowing what's going on in someone's life, but they could be totally isolated on their own little patch of land in this big state and feeling connected. I love hearing people mention listening to Wyoming Public Radio when they're doing things, when they're just out. It's them and the elements and Wyoming Public Radio, you know? So it's again a reminder of just how sacred that relationship between, audio and a listener can be.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska.
And now to The Road to Cheyenne, our special series tracking the 2024 election. With less than 2 weeks until the polls close on November 5th, we're taking a look at the competitive races that will determine the balance of power in Wyoming's State House. Today with me are Wyoming Public Radio's State House reporter, Chris Clements, Hannah Haberman, our tribal reporter, and Jeff Fichter, who covers Albany County for us. So let's start with a race that will decide whether there is Indigenous representation in the state legislature. Hannah, this race is for House District 33.
So Democrat Ivan Posey is challenging current Republican incumbent Sarah Penn. It's an interesting district, representing a big chunk of the Wind River Reservation and non-reservation land, too. Posey's an enrolled member of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe, and if he doesn't win, there will be no Native state lawmakers this year.
And that's because Navajo Senator Afi Ellis was the only Indigenous lawmaker, but she's retiring this year. So tell me a little bit more about Penn and Posey.
Penn's endorsed by the Freedom Caucus. She is a nurse practitioner and has lived in Fort Washakie for the last 10 years. In 2022, she unseated Andy Clifford, who's Northern Arapaho and a Democrat. Penn beat her by 55-44%.
Okay, and just for clarification, Andy Clifford is now known as Andy LeBeau. And what about Posey?
Posey was born and raised on the Wind River Reservation. He's served in the U.S. Army and on the Shoshone Business Council. Now he's the tribal education coordinator at Central Wyoming College.
Great. And where do they stand on policy?
They both participated in a League of Women Voters forum earlier this month, recorded by County 10. One big difference was funding for early childhood education.
Kids at that age need to be home. And I don't support sending our children off, unless it's a parent's choice, but not funded by taxpayers at the young ages of 2, 3, 4.
It does have a place in our society. I think the idea is the younger we start them in education, the end result is to keep them in the state.
Both candidates said they were personally pro-life, but disagreed on the role of the government in reproductive health.
I believe that it's still a woman's choice, and the federal government or state government should have no role in telling that woman what to do.
Life is life, and it should be protected from conception until natural death.
Any other big takeaways?
Posey emphasized more education for both Native and non-Native people about one another, while Penn advocated to stop what she called the creep of government and audit state agencies to cut back on budgets.
All right, well, we'll have to wait and see what happens there. Thanks, Hannah. So switching gears, Chris, you've been looking into another race that will help decide who controls the legislature this January.
Yeah, I've been watching House District 4, which includes Platte County and Northwest Laramie County.
Who are the people to know in that race?
So that'd be Wheatland Representative Jeremy Haroldson and his Democratic challenger, Charles Randolph.
Let's start with Haroldson. He's the incumbent.
Right, and he's a member of the Freedom Caucus. He was actually vice chair of the caucus until not long ago. This race will help see if the caucus gains a majority in the House. In the last session, Haroldson sponsored a bill that would have removed all state-run gun-free zones, but it ended up getting vetoed. He was also focused on finding funds to fix an ailing water tank in Wheatland.
His district has favored Republicans pretty reliably, right?
His district has voted for the GOP in every election since at least 1977. I actually spoke with Haroldson this week, and he told me he's betting on being reelected.
The position of Speaker Pro Tem is something that I'm definitely looking at being a part of and helping serve my state in that way.
He's so sure he's going to win, he talked to me about what he plans to do next session. And that includes a bill that would give county clerks the option to do hand count audits of ballots cast in elections. Currently, tabulator machines do that audit. So I asked him if he was concerned that doing those audits might delay getting results back after Election Day or might be inaccurate.
So my thought would be to have a tabulator give us our results and then a hand count quantify those results.
That will be a bill to watch. Maybe put it on your to-do list, Chris.
That list, it's growing longer by the day. One last thing on Haroldson. In terms of how big the Freedom Caucus's majority will be, Haroldson didn't give me a firm number, but he did say it likely won't be the coveted two-thirds majority that would make their bills veto-proof.
So even though he's confident he's going to win, Haroldson does have a Democratic opponent, Charles Randolph.
Yep. Randolph is a retired railroad worker living between Chugwater and Wheatland. He's been involved in Democratic Party politics in one way or another for years, and he told me that if he gets voted into office, his big priority will be to push the development of rare earth minerals, especially in Albany County.
Okay, and why is he running?
Well, he views Haroldson and the Freedom Caucus as too extreme for Wyoming. By way of an example, he mentioned that they backed a ban on gender-affirming care for minors this past session.
They took away the rights for parents to decide how their children can or cannot get medical treatment for their, you know, gender and stuff like that. And to me, that's just wrong.
He said he doesn't appreciate the way they tend to vote together on bills, including Haroldson.
He's going to be out there taking phone calls, voting for this, not voting that, because he's told to do that.
Is that accurate?
There may be some truth to that. The former chair of the caucus told me that new members are only admitted after they have a proven voting record that supports the caucus agenda. So uniformity is kind of part of the entry fee.
All right. Thanks, Chris. And to Jeff, you've been watching Albany County.
Yep. There are four races I'm watching, some more competitive than others. House District 13 includes University of Wyoming student housing and is a pretty safe Democratic seat. The incumbent, a law professor named Ken Chestick, does, however, face a challenge from Republican Shane Sweat. At the other extreme is House District 46, which is a pretty safe Republican seat. In the last election, Ocean Andrew won with nearly 70% of the vote. And this year, he is technically being challenged by a Democrat, but that Democrat suspended his campaign, saying it was just too much to balance with his full-time job.
And Andrew's a member of the Freedom Caucus?
That's right. So if he wins, which looks likely, the Freedom Caucus is one step closer to having a majority in the House.
Okay, so if I'm following along, that sounds like one pretty safe seat for Republicans and one safe seat for Democrats. What about the other two House races?
The other two are a bit more hotly contested. House 14 and House 45 are more evenly divided between Republican and Democratic voters.
So let's start with House District 14.
So House 14 covers most of Albany County north of Laramie, and it also includes some neighborhoods within the city. But it's largely rural and leans Republican. Yet it's represented by a Democrat, Trey Sherwood, who is now seeking a third term.
How did that happen?
Sherwood is a solid vote for her party on abortion rights and against anti-LGBTQ legislation, but she's also sold herself as something of a champion for rural interests. For example, during the last session, Sherwood got funding for a one-room schoolhouse in her district. The ranchers in that area had been fighting tooth and nail for that school, and Sherwood helped them to get it. So a lot of these ranchers view Sherwood as someone who will go to bat for them, despite being a Democrat. There are even campaign signs up around the district that say Republicans for Sherwood. Ranchers in Garrett even made Sherwood the Grand Marshal of their July 4th parade.
So that's fascinating. I feel like we are constantly hearing how the country's polarized and Republicans and Democrats can't work together anymore, but that kind of refutes it.
I'd say it's definitely an example of all politics being local in some way. However, the election is still competitive. There's a Republican challenger, Joe Giustosi.
What's his deal?
Giustosi moved to Wyoming 4 years ago. He's mostly avoided interviews and forums. His campaign website doesn't go too much into the weeds on policy, except that he agrees with one specific free market economist who argues that states like Wyoming should limit taxes and cut spending.
And you mentioned that he moved here 4 years ago?
That's right. But he's actually not the most recent transplant. That distinction goes to another candidate, Paul Crouch, who moved to Wyoming just last year. He's running in House 45 and is trying to unseat the incumbent Democrat there, Carly Provenza.
And how do those two candidates differ?
Provenza is a strong advocate for criminal justice reform, police accountability, rental tenant protections, and Medicaid expansion. She's known in Laramie as a community organizer who's worked on issues like police oversight and housing. Crouch, on the other hand, is very conservative. He supports the various anti-transgender bills passed by the current legislature, wants to see more public money spent on private schools through voucher programs, and he believes most abortion should be illegal. So I'll definitely be watching this race on election night.
Thanks, Jeff. And we're going to end with something every Wyomingite will see on their ballot. There is a constitutional amendment regarding property taxes. Chris, can you explain what this is?
Sure. It's an incredibly complicated proposal. Depending on the outcome, it could change part of the Wyoming Constitution. So if approved, it would create a separate rate of taxation for all residential property, like multifamily, single-family property. Within that, it would create a subclass specifically for owner-occupied primary residences and tax those folks differently. The legislature tried and failed to pass a law last session that would have given tax cuts for single-family homes, but Governor Gordon said it violated the state constitution, which only has three different classes for property taxes right now. And those are mineral products, industrial properties, and then pretty much everything else. When you consider that, along with our surging property tax rate, there's clearly an appetite for figuring out a reduction in the tax burden.
So why is this on the ballot now?
Well, this amendment started out as a Senate resolution in 2023. At the time, some legislators said they were worried that this change to the Constitution wouldn't really provide property tax relief, just create a new class that could be taxed more or less depending on who's in charge in Cheyenne. But the bill eventually passed, and now it needs more than half of Wyoming voters to back it before it becomes law.
Okay, and how will this property tax change impact me and my home specifically?
If the amendment passes and the legislature decides afterward to lower property taxes under this new subclass, it could provide you with some relief, Camila, but the amendment doesn't answer a bunch of questions that could prove to be important down the road. For instance, if you run a business out of your home, it seems unclear how your property would be taxed then.
Got it. So I shouldn't open up Comma Corner's bagel shop from my house.
Stick to a storefront location for right now, Camila, until we get some of these tax questions answered.
All right, I'll hold off altogether. Well, thank you so much to all of you. That's a wrap for this episode of Road to Cheyenne. We'll be back November 1st, where we'll talk about election security and more to prepare you for the general election on November 5th. It was and still is an active wildfire season for Wyoming. Up next on Open Spaces, we hear from someone who goes to the front lines of fires to help contain and document them.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
My name is Conrad Smith. I grew up in Kansas, but I've lived in Laramie for 18 years now. I think that the primary function of public radio, at least in my opinion, is news and keeping public officials accountable. The entertainment is available many other places, but good quality news is not widely available, and I do believe Wyoming Public Radio has the best broadcast news in the United States right now. The service public radio provides is worth paying for, I guess, quite simply. Anybody who listens a lot has kind of a moral obligation to help pay the bills.
Begin or renew your membership on our secure website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Click on the Pledge Now link. Thanks for your support.
Neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki basically lived at her lab.
I just felt really, really bad.
So she started working out, which improved more than just her muscles.
My focus was working better, and that made me say, what's going on here?
Wendy's discovery has kept her active ever since. New ideas to help you keep your resolutions. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Wyoming Public Radio.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back?
It does, on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, the Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Hotshot crews are sent to the front lines of some of the largest wildfires in the country.
We get to be places and see things that maybe I wouldn't go see otherwise.
Kyle Miller captains Wyoming's hotshot crew. He's been capturing the bravery behind the job with his camera for more than 20 years, and also ways that it's becoming more challenging.
We've had years where fires have just burned more active. They've done things that we haven't expected.
Miller's photos are part of an exhibition on wildland firefighting opening this weekend at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats got a preview in the gallery.
In this photo here, this is a photo off of the Pine Gulch fire in Colorado, which at the time was the largest in Colorado's history. Very long shifts. We'd been on rolling into what we call swing shifts, where we start in the afternoon and we might be working through the night. And so this picture is of one of our squad leaders, Anna, and I think her face pretty well is showing exactly how we all felt at this point in the night. This is right before sunup, and we're all extremely tired. We've been burning all night. And at this point, you can see the embers starting to wash over the line. And all we could think of is, we're so close to having this tied in here. Are we going to lose it right now?
And so what happened? Did you lose it, or were you able to contain it?
We got lucky. The relative humidities happened to be high enough right there that nothing ended up taking. And ended up containing it and being able to be done with the shift sometime just after sunrise.
Yeah, and that worry that you might just have to keep going, stay up all night, that it might get away from you, and also just being the fear part of just being so close to these flames, like, how do you deal with that part?
The actual fire, like, honestly, it's just one of those things that, and it probably always sounds funny, but there's not like a fear aspect to it. You become very acclimatized to the environment, I guess. You know, the real actual danger in fire is typically it's being struck by a tree. It's not the fire itself. It's the burned out trees and the people that are having to fall them to make the line safe that are really actually the dangerous aspects. Yeah, this is one of our Sawyers. He's carrying his saw, hiking down the road, and next to him he's basically hiking into the sunset, and the sun's streaming through the smoke and the flames as the fire's moving up through the trees. And being in Northern California, the tree height is pretty tall, and so he's walking next to probably 200-foot flames on some of these trees as they're coming off the tops of them. And so it's just one of those things that you get to see that it's a unique experience. It's hard to really put into words.
So we hear a lot about how fires are getting more intense, longer, with climate change. And you've been working in fires, fighting fires, for more than 20 years. And I'm just curious what you've seen over that time period.
Yeah, and I'm not a climate scientist by any means, so I don't feel like I'm somebody that can really speak to its impacts. But what I have seen on the ground is, I remember when going to a 100,000 acre fire, I thought that was huge. And now that's just becoming more and more common. I've been to one in California that was just shy of 1 million acres. So the scale of the fires are definitely increasing. The challenge of containing them is increasing. And also, dude, there's a lot of variables that come into play. There's just more and more people moving into that urban interface. There's more structures that we have to work around. We actively try and do prescribed fire, but the reality of being able to actually keep up with the fire load and get the forest back into that healthy state and get fires back in what's called your fire regime, where fires occurring at a healthy interval, it's a huge, huge challenge. We're seeing more fires behaving in ways that we don't necessarily expect them to. Some of the predictions that we've made based on past fire behavior that we've observed, it's changed, and not true of every fire that we go to by any means, but the likelihood that it's going to happen has been slowly increasing over the course of my career.
What do you think that means for hotshot crews?
It means longer summers. Fires are burning longer, they're burning hotter. The demand on the hotshot crews is becoming more and more. We're starting to see more of that firefighter burnout in the wildland community, where the demand is high enough that, you know, most people don't want to be actively working 16 hours a day all summer with very, very few days off, and extending those seasons out, adding a month here. I mean, we're seeing that this year, where the fire season just doesn't want to turn off. Normally by the 1st of October, things have really mellowed out. There's some fires burning, and usually it's California. But as far as the rest of the country, usually the rest of the country is shut off if we continue on this trend of more active fires and higher demand. We're going to start to see the repercussions of that on the number of people that are applying to hotshot crews and to fire in general. We see it in our hiring numbers. The number of applicants that we get is slowly decreasing every year. And at a certain point, you know, we just won't have the people to deal with the load that we're expected to deal with.
This one, describe it. What do you see in this photo?
This has been one of my favorite photos. It's part of the crew gathered around a campfire. This is a late season fire in Wyoming, and it was cold. What keeps, I feel like, most of us coming back is the level of camaraderie that you have with the people that you work with. These are all the same people that I work with year in, year out, every day. Get up, we eat together, we work together, we come have dinner together, and then we all camp together for most of the season. And so this, you know, this is one of those more relaxing times that we get to unwind a little bit after a shift on a fire and actually just kind of enjoy ourselves. And this is really what being on a hotshot crew is about. It's about the camaraderie and the people that you work with. You have a lot of really good people that you get to surround yourself with.
That was Captain of Wyoming's Hotshot Crew, Kyle Miller, speaking about his wildland fire photography exhibition at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, today's audio producer and digital producer, and a thank you to our social media manager, Cody Hume. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.